Session number 881, Major Patrick Chilton, Reel 1.
When did you join the Army?
Well, I joined in the beginning of 1937, and I went to Dover for 4 months. But I became aware that the home battalions never had any troops of any quantity, and I was very keen to go to India, where my first battalion was stationed. And so I was very lucky, and I got drafted in September 1937, and I had to take a draft out to India of 60 men and 10 band boys. Now, these band boys were then at the age of 14 to join the band in India. And so I went out in HMS Lancashire, which was a trooper, and it was a 3-week voyage to Karachi. The conditions of the men, I must say, were fairly appalling. It was very rough in the Bay of Biscay. I had to go down to the troop deck, which was their only deck. They slept there in hammocks, they ate there, and when it was rough, I can tell you the conditions were appalling, with the soldiers being sick and everything. But times got better when we got to Gibraltar and we went through the Mediterranean. And then it got very hot in the Red Sea. The humidity was terrific. And so the troops had to go up on deck. There was nothing else for it. We rigged up a swimming pool and canvas for them. And we had these air vents of canvas to try and get them cool in our mess deck. But still it was very, very hot. And after 3 weeks, we landed at Karachi.
How old were you at the time?
How old was I?
Yes.
I was then 19. And I had another officer under me in command. And when I got to Karachi, I found there was an enormous box in the hold, which I had to get to Landikotal, where I was to go, where the regiment was. It was full of toys for the children, Christmas toys, which had to be shipped out in the box. I had a lot of trouble getting this enormous box of toys on the train. Anyhow, we set off under movement control. We got to Peshawar, and then we had to change trains, because surprisingly, there is a railway right through the Khyber Pass to Landikotal. And off we set. We got to Landikotal, which is right at the top of the Khyber Pass, right on the Afghan frontier. And there, to my surprise, we were met not only by the bands and drums of the regiment, but all the officers. And the commanding officer welcomed us. We were taken in his car and driven to the mess.
Were you used to dealing with such quantities of men under your control?
No, not a bit. Because when I joined the regiment, very few men joined the army in those days, and all the overseas regiments had to be supplied with men. So I was very surprised that when I saw who I had, they were a very rough lot. Some even came from Dartmoor prison and places like that. Recruiting was very difficult in those days. Men were very badly paid, the conditions were pretty appalling in the British Army, and we had to get what we could. And I think a lot of men were released from prison, provided they joined the army and possibly were sent abroad. So I was rather astounded to have to command 60 men of that caliber. Having come from a public school in Sandhurst, I was never acquainted with those type of people. However, I am very glad to say that all those men became first-class soldiers. To steal from a comrade in the British Army is the lowest thing possible. They quickly realized that. They quickly realized discipline, the value of discipline, and they made splendid soldiers.
What were your quarters like on the voyage?
Well, the British officers' quarters were very good. This is something which I think may have been rather disgraceful, because the men's quarters were perfectly appalling. As I described, with hammocks, mess decks, they were crowded together. And in a troop ship, you possibly get 3,000 men travelling out to India on a 3-week voyage. And the only ports of call where they were allowed ashore was Port Said, which is not a very healthy climate for a young British soldier to be in.
But you yourself?
Well, ourselves, the officers, we had extremely good quarters, as I said. We had, of course, the first-class accommodation, because these troopers belonged to Bibby Line and were, they were commandeered, maybe, from the line for trooping purposes.
Were you given much information about India before you were sent
there? No, none at all, except you could buy books from officers who had been out there. What to wear, what kit you want, Rorke chairs, pith helmets. Now, we had to buy all those things in those days. They weren't provided. So we used to go to Hawks and Savile Row, and they supplied what they called an officer's camping kit. That included a wash basin in canvas on stilts, a Rorke chair and tents, and, of course, the usual pith helmet and the Woolsey helmet. The Woolsey helmet being a very heavy helmet with silver lining, because in those days they thought that sunstroke was so easily got, which of course the myth disappeared in the Western Desert when the troops went about with a tin helmet on and never suffered any sunstroke at all.
But did you find these other items quite useful?
Oh yes, because when one did do this campaigning, one had these little tents, and of course you had your Indian bearer with you in those days. You didn't get a batman as you get in England. You had an English, an Indian bearer. And they used to rig up all these things. Your bath, your wash basin so you could shave, and your Rorke chair to have your whiskey and soda in the evening.
What were your first impressions of India when you landed?
Well, I think possibly that I'd never been abroad in my life before. Was the poverty, which struck me as being appalling. There was this caste system, as everybody knows, from the Brahmin, who was the highest, to the sweeper in the lowest. And if a shadow of a sweeper passed over a Brahmin's food, he threw it away. Now, this rather astounded me, being an Englishman. I never discovered that things could happen that way. They were very friendly, very nice people, and I got very fond of my bearer, who I had for many years, and he still sends me Christmas cards today. He was a Mohammedan, and when we eventually left India, he was very frightened that what would happen to the Mohammedans.
Were you given any special training to carry out your role?
Oh, very much so. We were in tribal territory. We weren't in British India. And mountain training was what we had to do. Now, this meant that on columns, the idea was that you sent a picket ahead of you up on what we used to call the Cud, which was the hills. And they stayed there until the column passed through, and they were waved down by a red flag at the end of the column to run down the hill and join the column. Meanwhile, at the head of the column, the next cud had to be picketed on both sides, because we always used the passes to pass through. See, we had mules and donkeys, we had all sorts of things to carry our equipment. And it wasn't until later, when Alexander, who was our brigadier, who became later the field marshal, introduced tanks to carry our equipment. This was the first time that they were used actually on the frontier.
Were these precautions usually necessary?
Absolutely necessary. Don't forget, we were in tribal territory. We weren't under the British government, except for certain conditions. But we had a political agent. And the political agent's job was to bribe the tribes, not to fire at us. They found this fairly lucrative for a long time, but occasionally, particularly in the winter months when the crops were taken in, you had trouble, and we had to be sent out to punish the tribes. Now, the great chap there in those days was known as the Fakir of Ipe, And he caused us a lot of trouble, always raiding not only villages, but sometimes he'd attack our troops. For instance, if we went out riding outside the camp, we had to have one of the tribesmen with us. Now, this was a matter of bribery. He carried a rifle. It probably didn't go off, but it didn't make any difference. The tribes didn't fire at us because he was being paid. This was bribery, and the political agent was quite willing to hand out rupees by the ends to protect us from trouble. It was the cheapest way, the cheapest insurance that we could have. So when we went on ordinary training, we always had four or five tribesmen with 800 men to protect us. This was just bribery, there was nothing else to it, but they did keep quiet. But when we had to go on punitive expeditions, that was a different matter. The job was to get to the village, burn the crops, destroy the houses, and return to our camp. Now, when I arrived, this was the thing that was done. But after 6 months, the RAF took over these punitive expeditions. And what they did was they ran over the village, dropped pamphlets, warning the villagers they must get out, take their invalid, old, sick with them into the hills. 24 hours later, the RAF had come over and they would bomb the village, which of course was only made of mud, so it wasn't very difficult to bomb, and set fire with incendiaries to their crops. Now, this was the punishment for rebelling against our rule.
Was it quite effective?
I believe so. I think today the Pakistan government are having a lot of trouble with the tribesmen like we had. They don't seem to have the effective power, or perhaps the means of bribery that we used to use to keep them quiet.
Did you go on any training exercises with the RAF?
No, we were quite apart, really, from the RAF. The RAF then were mainly in defence of the frontier against Afghanistan, because, like today, we were always frightened of Russia coming through, and the only entry into India was virtually the Khyber Pass, and that's why we had a brigade of troops right at the top, and the RAF was standing by to help. They had very old Hawker aircraft, but it seemed to be quite effective.
Was there much cooperation with the Indian?
Very much so. Of course, we had the Indian cavalry and the Indian infantry. Now, up at Landakotal, the British Army in India was always two Indian regiments and one British. Every brigade had this. The idea being that the presence of British troops helped the Indians to fight better. Now, in our case, we had the 1st, 12th Punjabis. We had the 1st, 5th Gurkhas. Now, of course, they're not Indian troops. They're mercenaries. But they're wonderful fighters. And we had the 1st Dorsets, which was my regiment. Now, we got on frightfully well with the Gurkhas because the British Army can always go into any Gurkha canteen or barrack room. They're the only place we can go. We're not ever allowed into an Indian canteen. But the Gurkhas we could. They're very similar to British troops, you know. They drink because they're not Muslim. They swear, just like the British troops. And they knit. They knit like mad. They knit all their own socks and everything. And they're wonderful troops. And they go back to Nepal every 2 years so that they can raise their families, because they die rather young. And these Gurkha troops, roughly about 15 to 16 years old. And of course they're all commanded by British officers.
And what were relations with the Punjabis?
Punjabis were all right. With regards to the officers, of course, they were mostly British. Some of them were Indian officers. But we never weren't allowed, really, to the British troops to mix with them. There was no opportunity because, apart from training together, they weren't allowed in their barrack rooms or their canteens.
How conscious were you that the training you were being given?
Well, we were very conscious. We were mountain troops. When the war came, of course, as always in the British Army, we were then turned into seaborne troops. we expected we'd be sent to Norway or somewhere like that, but of course we weren't. We were sent to Malta. Of course, our training was virtually valueless for the war that was to come. But we were very valuable, I think, in the keeping down the tribal wars, not only against the British, but they'd attack each other's villages.
Do you know any of their motives at all?
Well, I think mainly to steal rifles. They're very warlike, and they're still very warlike, the Bataan. But he's a very lovable person. But he's a master theft. And there is a story of a rather pompous brigadier commanding an Indian battalion who said that no Bataan could ever penetrate his lines and steal anything from him. Now, word got back to the chief of the Bataan tribe, and the result was the brigadier went to bed that night fully clothed in his pajamas, but he woke up with nothing on at all.
Did any instances of that happen while you were there?
Well, our main concern was our rifles. They have their own rifle factory, which they can make rifles. But they're not as good as the British, particularly the bore. Now, the rule was always that a man, after training, put his rifle in a thing called a coat. Now, the coat had steel windows and two guards all night, awake, with chains round every rifle. But in spite of that, we found somehow these Bataans, who were so marvellous at stealing, managed to get in, extract a bore from a rifle, and put one of their own back in again so it wouldn't be noticed. And it was only noticed during the inspections, when we had rifle inspection, that that was not a British bore. Particularly if the soldier was not firing particularly well. They were as smart as that.
All this without the guards realising?
Well, nobody knows how it was done.
About how many men were in the camp on the whole?
Well, at Llandicotal, well, we had a brigade with some artillery, which means that about 1,800 men, plus artillery and a small staff. That's the brigade commander's staff. Brigade commander being, of course, in charge. And he, of course, was under the Commander-in-Chief, Northwest Frontier Province, who was in Peshawar.
And were you very far from any other British posts?
Well, the next British post was Peshawar, which was at the end of the Khyber Pass, which was about 20 miles away. But communications were quite good, because, as I said before, we had a railway running right up to Llandicotal, which was a masterpiece of engineering, I may say. There were 23 tunnels that had to be dug to get the railway through. Then there was the tarmac road, and then there was the caravan track. Now, these caravans come down from Persia, and they come down, and we used to put them in a site ready, because we couldn't allow them through the pass without being protected. There'd be about something like 500 camels loaded with Persian carpets, and they took the caravan route while we took the main tarmac route with armoured cars. And we'd take them down as far as Shargai Fort, which was the end of the Khyber into British India. And then from then on, they were on their own, and they went right down as far as Calcutta with camels, selling their carpets, which their wives had made in their villages in Persia.
And did you take them coming up the other way?
No, because they had no, virtually nothing worth stealing. We didn't bother. But going down, we had to protect them through the pass.
Did you see anything of Bataans Ulven on purely military occasions?
Oh yes, because we used to entertain them once a year, sports. Now for this we had a big shamiana. We had a sports ground. And we used to send invitations to all the tribal chiefs to come. They used to arrive, funny enough, in quite big cars. But the one snag was they all carried their rifles. Now, we didn't want any scenes going on, any trouble. So we used to disarm them with labels, and their rifles were held in a coat. They were always surprised me as being most friendly, and they used to put their arms around each other. Bets used to be taken, and sports used to begin. This took the form of tug of war, cud racing, that was a track up the hills and down again, and various other sort of entertainments, particularly the bagpipes. They were very good players of bagpipes, and we used to have competitions as who could play the best tunes. After all this happened, we used to entertain them to tea in this big shamiana. They couldn't have been more friendly. They were delightful people. In fact, they're so funny in their temperament, because they once killed one of the guide's colonels on a campaign. Now, they were terribly sorry about this. They didn't mind shooting a soldier, but to kill the colonel was something awful. So they sent messages that they'd like to come to his funeral. The same conditions applied. They arrived, their rifles were taken away, and they literally wept bitterly at the funeral of the man they'd killed. Now, this is their funny sort of temperament about things. But we, ourselves, campaigning, could never leave a wounded soldier behind, because he'd be tortured. So we always had to recover him. So therefore, this is their sort of funny attitude, together with us, or with their fellow tribesmen. They'd be delighted to meet each other, shake hands, but the next day they might raid his village and rape his women. You could never tell them.
Were the games and sports between British troops and
tribesmen? No, it entirely tribesmen. Okay. I'm sure, particularly cud racing, the British troops would not have shown up very well. They had shooting matches, you know, all that sort of thing.
And they accepted the judge's verdict quite
well? Oh, yes, perfectly well. But there was nothing to accept, because the tug of war was decisive. The winner of the cud races was decisive. So there was never any argument. And when they left in their cars, they were handed back their rifles and ammunition, and off they went quite happily back to their huts or their villages.
Could any of the tribesmen speak English at all?
Very few. Because we always had the political agent who was great friends with them, because he bribed them all the time, and his staff, who all spoke Bataan.
What did you think of the general quality of leadership of the army?
Well, that was very fine. We had some wonderful soldiers who later became very famous. Alexander, Auchinleck, Slim, the finest commanders you could ever wish to see. It was a wonderful training ground for first-class officers commanding native troops, because the native troops were quite magnificent. They were very highly disciplined. And as we know, of course, with the 8th Indian Division in the war, they behaved magnificently.
How did people react to the Indianization of the army? Did they think this was a good thing or something?
You mean the Indian people or the British people?
Well, the Indian appointments as officers.
Well, I think that was all right. They were always a bit frightened of change. Under British rule, India was a very quiet place. I mean, I know we had Amritsar and things in the past, and there were riots and so on, but nothing compared with after we handed over, when massacred. Oh, people, thousands were massacred. We never know how many were massacred. I think that they're a bit wary about this change in many ways. But it's worked out pretty well now, I suppose. But I've never been back. I don't think I have any wish to go back.
Did it cause problems in mess life, for example?
Well, I don't think so. Of course, we were very segregated. We had our own clubs, which no Indians were allowed into. I don't know, we never thought this was peculiar at the time. I think I would today. But in those days, no, we didn't associate with Indian officers at all. We had our own clubs, complete with swimming pool, tennis, polo ground, And this is the sort of sports we indulge in. And same with our hunting. We had the Peshawar Vale hunt, and we had the Rizalpur hounds we used to go out with. Always meeting at 5 o'clock in the morning. We'd hunt the sugar cane. That's the jackal we were hunting, of course. Not the fox, but we had British foxhounds out there. And we had good sport. And at 11 o'clock, when the scent went, we'd pack up, come back, and have a jolly good lunch at the Peshawar Club.
What other things did you hunt? Did you hunt pigs at all?
Papers?
Pigs or other wild animals?
No, we didn't not up there. We didn't have many. No, that was more central India, the pig sticking and things like that. No, our entertainment was merely fox hunting. And the cinema, we had a cinema out there, which was rather fun, actually, because you used to sit in sofas, and they used to stop the film half-time so we could have the drinks served by the bearers, and then the film would go on when we had our chota pegs, as they used to call them, or burra pegs, which was the large whiskey and soda. So we had the cinema, but we had dances every Saturday night at the Shark Club. But of course the problem there was partners. Young subalterns were not married. You had the wives, and then you had a thing called a fishing fleet. Now the fishing fleet used to come out from England. They were always called that because they were girls, unmarried, who had sisters or perhaps fathers serving out there, and for the winter they used to come out, perhaps in the hopes of finding a mate. Well, they certainly found those. They were very popular, and we had great fun with them. And then in the spring, rather like birds of emigration, they go back to England.
Did you have much contact with British civilians at all?
Well, there weren't any, really. You see, British civilians out there were mostly what we used to call chichi. They were either children of mixed Indian British birth. All the railways were run by chichis. You always knew them because they always wore a topi, and they ran the railways. The civil administration there was practically all military. Magistrates, yes, we had British magistrates, but we had a lot of Indian magistrates too. We were gradually in those days handing over